for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Healthcare is in the news again this week. A new study showed a spike in health insurance premiums. And yesterday, the Obama administration asked the Supreme Court to rule on a key element of the Affordable Care Act. Joining me in the studio to talk about these developments, Ron Pollack of Families USA, Julie Robner of NPR, and Joseph Antos of the American Enterprise Institute. Before we begin our conversation here in the studio, joining us by phone from Menlo Park, California, is Larry Levitt. He's Senior Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
Outline for us, if you would, what your 2011 employer benefits survey actually found.
Well, I mean, I think probably the most significant thing it found is that the premium, health insurance premium for a family is now over $15,000 a year, which is up 9% over last year. And that comes at a time when workers and families are struggling with the economic downturn. In fact, at the same time that premiums were up 9%, workers' wages were up just 2%. So premiums have continued to rise much faster than workers' ability to afford them.
So what is driving the sharp rise?
Well, you know, what typically drives increases in health insurance premiums is the underlying cost of health care, and certainly the cost of health care is up. But something slightly different looks like it was going on this year as well, which is that insurers expected us to come, in fact, as many of us did, expected us to come out of the economic downturn more quickly than we actually did. During the recession, people cut back on health care just like they cut back on lots of other things in their family budgets. And insurers expected people to start using more health care services, going to the doctor more, filling more prescriptions as the economy improved. The economy hasn't mostly improved, so they kind of overshot this year. So premiums actually increased a little bit faster than the actual cost of health care, and you know, to some extent that's leading to higher profits for the
Really, how do the companies justify those increases?
Well, you know, in many ways, again, you know, a big part of the premium dollar goes towards actual healthcare services, and in fact, there are some new rules in the healthcare reform law that passed a couple years ago that guarantee that. I mean, the law requires that for individuals and for small businesses, at least 80% of the healthcare dollar, that premium dollar, goes towards actual healthcare services, and going forward, that should help. You know, keep premium increases down a bit and ensure that not too much of the premium goes to overhead and profits.
Okay, but Larry, tell me this. If the companies did raise those premiums in anticipation of coming out of the recession, what happened to the profits that they took from those premiums?
Well, those they show up as profits. I mean, most of the insurance industry is now dominated by for-profit insurance companies that, you know, have stock out there. So, you know, in many cases, this has boosted their stock prices. I think the question is big question is going forward, what happens? I mean, do the premiums continue to go up next year, or you know, is there some competitive pressure that is brought to bear that, you know, helps moderate these increases?
Did the survey, Larry, give you any sense of what effect, if any, the Obama administration's Affordable Care Act had on these insurers' decisions to raise premiums?
Yeah, well, you know, for better or worse, the most of the Affordable Care Act, the health reform law, doesn't go into effect till 2014.
Right.
So, you know, it really is having a modest effect right now. One thing we did find is there are a couple provisions that did go into effect this year that increased benefits for people and had a very modest effect on premiums. So, for example, kids up to age 26 can now stay on their parents' insurance policies. And we asked employers how many kids enrolled as a result of this provision and found that this year 2.3 million kids up to age 26 were able to get insurance by staying on their parents' policies. Also, this year, insurance companies and employers, most of them are required to provide preventive services, things like vaccinations, immunizations, cancer screenings, cholesterol screenings. They're required to provide those services at no cost to patients. And that's also something that millions of people have benefited from.
So are you able to tell what effect, if any, these two provisions had on premium hikes?
Yeah, our estimate is that of the 9% increase in the premium this year, no more than 1 to 2% percentage points of that are due to the provisions of the health reform law.
Okay, so Larry, are we to conclude that 7 to 8% of those premium hikes went straight to profit?
Not straight to profits, because you know the actual cost of healthcare went up as well. So insurance.
How much?
Varying estimates, but it looks like the actual cost of healthcare is probably going up in the 5 to 6-7% range.
So you're saying then that the 2% that went to these two changes, preventive services and having kids on their parents' insurance, that went up, that accounted for about 2%, and then cost hikes in provision of medicine accounted for another 5 to 6%. So you're saying the insurance companies took only 1%.
You know, no question that profits did go up this year. And it's also important to keep in mind that a fairly small percentage of the premium ends up going to profits. You know, it's in the range of usually 2, 3, 4%. So even if, you know, an extra 1% of the premium went to higher profits, it's a big increase in profits.
Yeah, but, I mean, isn't it tough to justify those kind of profits when the economy is in such a terrible place and when individuals are struggling to keep health insurance?
No question that this increase in premiums is coming at just about the worst time for families and employers. And I think, you know, the hope is that there are some things going into effect in the health reform law that will help this kind of minimum, what's called a medical loss ratio. So a requirement that a certain, at least 80% of the premium dollar go towards actual healthcare services, not overhead and profits. Also, states are starting, in fact, just this month, are starting to review any premium increase above 10%. And that should help moderate increases a little bit as well. And then, you know, starting in 2014, the really big pieces, assuming the Supreme Court allows it to happen, the really big pieces of the health reform law go into effect, which will help people pay their premiums. It'll create these purchasing exchanges, which will increase the buying power of small businesses and individuals. And, you know, the hope is that will help help bring premium increases down as well.
Larry Leavitt, he's Senior Vice President of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
And turning now to you, Julie Robner, let's put aside the premium increase for a moment and talk about what the Justice Department did yesterday.
Well, it wasn't just the Justice Department. There was a flurry of petitions to the Supreme Court. The Justice Department and the 26 states and the National Federation of Independent Business and the people that they that they're representing all petitioned the Supreme Court to take up the case out of the 11th Circuit. This was the case, the appeals court case that found the individual mandate, the requirement that most people either have health insurance or pay a penalty, to be unconstitutional. Now, to go back a step, there have been so far three decisions out of appeals courts, and they disagree. And this is one reason that the Supreme Court would likely take up a case, because you have disagreement among the circuits. We had the Sixth Circuit that found the individual mandate to be constitutional. We had the 11th Circuit found it to be unconstitutional. And then we had the Fourth Circuit in Virginia that found it to be basically not ripe for decision yet. So we definitely have a disagreement among the circuits.
So about the timing now?
Now that we have, well, then I'm getting to that. Now that we have all the parties in the 11th Circuit saying, okay, Supreme Court, we think you should take it up, that's yet another reason for them to go ahead and do it this year. So if they were to take it up this year, that means that they would have arguments probably sometime later this year and decide it at the end. Presumably a big case like this, they would come out at the very end of the session. That would be the very end of June, for very first few days of July, right in the middle of the presidential election.
And when we come back, we're going to talk with Ron Pollack and Joe Antos about why Ron is optimistic there's going to be a favorable outcome, and Joe Antos may have another thought in mind. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And now, having heard from the Kaiser Family Foundation that insurance premiums have risen about 9%, and having heard as to reasons why, we turn to our experts here in the studio, Julie Robner, health correspondent for NPR and author of Healthcare Policy and Politics, A to Z. She's also contributing editor for National Journal Daily. Ron Pollack is executive director of Families USA. That's a national nonprofit organization for healthcare consumers. Joseph Antos is a specialist in retirement policy at the American Enterprise Institute. So, Ron Pollack, you are optimistic about what the Supreme Court will do with the Affordable Health Care Act.
Well, Diane, as someone who's argued cases in the Supreme Court, and I used to be a law school dean, I know it's always hazardous to predict what the Supreme Court, particularly this Supreme Court, is going to do. But I sat in on all of the Court of Appeals arguments, I'm optimistic for a variety of reasons. In the Sixth Circuit, which is based in Cincinnati, Judge Jeffrey Sutton, who is a very conservative judge, reputed by a lot of people to be the next Republican appointee, if there's a Republican president, to the Supreme Court. He wrote a lengthy opinion as to why this individual responsibility provision is constitutional. Last week, I sat in the courtroom listening to the argument in the Court of Appeals here in the District of Columbia, and you had two of the most conservative judges, Judge Brett Kavanaugh, a George W. Bush appointee, clerk for Scalia, and Judge Lawrence Silberman, a close friend of Clarence Thomas, and it was clear they had problems with the arguments attacking this individual responsibility provision on a number of grounds. One, that it could very well be constitutional based on the so-called Commerce Clause. But actually, there was yet another ground that these two judges actually had difficulty with the challenge, and that is they thought since this is all enforced through the Internal Revenue Code, this is a tax.
Interesting.
And now, I think one thing that's really important to understand, there is not a single court of appeals that has ruled that wherever they come out on this individual responsibility provision, that the rest of the Affordable Care Act should be invalidated. And clearly, the opponents of the Affordable Care Act want to invalidate the entire statute. That is not going to happen.
And Joe Antos, your thoughts on the Obama administration's chances for having the mandate provision upheld?
Well, I tend to agree with Ron, although maybe I'm not as confident as he is that the Supreme Court would go that way. But I'm not sure that it really matters. As you said, the Internal Revenue Service will enforce this, but not very well. In fact, they've basically said that only if someone who doesn't have insurance has overwithheld on their income taxes will they take any money at all, and that's assuming they can find that person. So I think this is really more a case of moral suasion. I think that's the real effect of the mandate. It's basically your mother telling you what to do, and it's the right thing to do, and it probably is the right thing to do to get insurance. But enforcement ain't going to happen.
And Diane, one other point I think is important to make. For those people who can afford health care coverage but choose not to get it, guess who winds up paying? It's all of us who buy insurance, because when somebody has an accident or a major illness and they wind up in an emergency room, somebody's got to pay the bill. And this adds more than $1,000 to the insurance premiums for family coverage for those of us who purchase insurance.
All right. Now, going back to the Kaiser Family Foundation survey, Joe, how do you read that 9% increase?
Well, I think the only thing you could say for sure is what we've known for decades, maybe since the invention of health insurance, which is every year healthcare costs rise. The 9% is a little hard to understand in the sense that there are a bunch of other surveys. This is a survey. There are a bunch of other surveys, and you get all sorts of different numbers. The Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, in sharp contrast, the very same day that the Kaiser Family Foundation report came out, announced a 3.8% increase for next year. Now, we have to be careful. That's looking forward. Kaiser Family looking backward. Hard to know what all that means.
Whoa. Julia, what do you think it means?
Yeah, well, what Larry was saying, and I think this is important, is that a lot of these insurance companies, and remember, it's not just insurance companies, 60% of people now are in what are called self-funded plans. So these are companies that are basically paying their own costs. So it's not just insurance company profits. In fact, now we have a majority that aren't insurance company profits. I think a lot of this really was people thinking, we know that during the recession, certainly during the height of the recession, people were not using a lot of medical care. We know that from the surveys that the government does about how much health spending went up, and it didn't go up very much. So there was every reason to believe there was this pent-up demand and that at some point people were going to start to go back and use the care at sort of a regular clip. And people assumed that if the economy was recovering, and it looked like, remember last year when they set these premiums, it looked like this was going to happen. So some of this was not really nefarious. It was the idea that, okay, if the economy is recovering, people are going to probably return to their regular use of medical care. So it wasn't just the insurance companies doing it. It was companies who self-fund their own plan doing it, setting their premiums. Because remember, they're collecting premiums, part of the premiums.
What about the recession and how it really did affect the premiums?
Premiums went up much more slowly the last couple of years, in fact. So this was a big spike from last year.
Okay.
But what we're seeing and what Joe is talking about is that because the economy did not recover, what we're seeing is that next year we're already seeing much smaller premium increases, hence the 3.8 increase for the federal employees plan. In fact, the most popular federal employees plan, the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan, which by far a majority of federal employees take, is only going up 1.6%. There's a Mercer study that's out, again, looking at next year, much smaller increases. I think the average is about 5%. Hmm. So it looks like this year was a spike. And as Larry said, it was a spike that was sort of an over-anticipation. Now, there are also provisions of the Affordable Care Act that basically require insurance companies not to overestimate, and that basically they can't keep the money in extra profits because there's something called this medical loss ratio. If they don't spend a certain percentage, depending on whether it's group or individual, 80 or 85%, then they have to give back that extra money in rebates.
Ron, what about the criticism of the Affordable Care Act that it didn't do enough to hold down costs?
Well, I think we're going to see that the Affordable Care Act provides significant relief for people. But before I just go over how it provides the relief, I think it's important to understand, as important as the Kaiser survey is, it's not an extraordinary finding, because if you looked at what happened over the past decade, you'll see that employer-sponsored health coverage has really diminished. And, you know, just give you a few numbers from the latest Census Bureau. The Census Bureau says that between 2000 and 2010, we had an increase in the overall population of almost 27 million people. And yet, at the same time, we had a reduction of almost 13 million people with job-based health care coverage. And the reason for that, of course, is that health premiums have gone up. In that same time period, premiums for family coverage rose from $6,772 in the year 2000 to almost $14,000 in 2010, and as the Kaiser folks are telling us, over $15,000 in 2011. So first, it's really important to understand that this has been a long-term problem.
Right.
That said, the Affordable Care Act does a variety of things that I think are going to be helpful. First, as you've already heard, it will hold insurance companies more accountable. If they want to increase premiums really significantly, now states have a greater capacity to review those proposed increases. The federal government has provided states, and particularly the insurance commissions, with more money so that they can hold the insurance companies accountable. You've seen rejections of premiums. I just picked a few. In North Dakota, one company wanted to go up to 23.7% in the year. In California, 16.4%. In Connecticut, 19.9%. In Oregon, 22.1%. Every one of those proposed increases were rejected. And so we now have new tools to try to make sure that these steep premiums do not increase. But one of the things that Larry said, and very much agree, is that there is an underlying cost of health care that is a factor. It's a significant factor. And there are a number of things that the Affordable Care Act does that should be helpful. We don't know yet what the magnitude will be in terms of what it will do to cost. But let me give you three things. First, we're going to have greater care coordination so that the people who have the greatest expenses are people who have chronic health conditions, and they often have multiple health conditions, and they often go to numerous different specialists. Now there's going to be improved care coordination. Secondly, we're going to have more research and dissemination of research about what are the different kinds of treatments that are most effective. Because a lot of the treatments that people get are ineffective, they're wasteful. We're going to know much more about that. We will have greater access to electronic medical records so that we won't have to spend as much time with paperwork. I can't tell you that any one or the combination of things are going to result in X percent reduction from what it otherwise would be, but they hold the potential for significant help. And one last thing, Diane, I'd say, we can go into this later in the program. The Affordable Care Act provides some real subsidy help for people who are going to need it, both for small businesses and to individuals and families. That's going to be helpful.
How do you respond, Joe?
Ron is right that, and Larry is too, that it's the underlying cost of health care that's the big issue. There are a bunch of other factors going on. There's a tremendous consolidation in the markets around hospitals. Hospitals are the big cost centers, and they're becoming more and more powerful. So when people like Ron say that we're going to hold insurers accountable, insurers are just agents in it, not in the sense of insurance agents.
But how about the healthcare cost makers?
Exactly right. Ron is optimistic. I wish I were as optimistic that we're going to see big improvements in coordination of care and more efficient delivery. But whether that happens or not, the problem lies with the medical establishment.
Joseph Bantos at the American Enterprise Institute. Time to open the phones. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Lena, Illinois, and to Sheila. Good morning to you. You're on the air.
Good morning. I was intrigued when you mentioned about putting off routine health care at the beginning of your show.
Yes.
Because my deductible is a $5,000 deductible in network, $16,000 out of network. And I had a routine test come back abnormal. And, yes, I am putting off going to get that retested because now that it's not considered wellness, now I need to pay for the whole thing myself, which is a risk I have to take because we choose not to take insurance through my husband's company, again, because it was a large deductible and many of the doctors were not within easy driving distance for
us.
So that was just a comment I had. I wanted to thank you for pointing that out, bringing that on to the public's awareness.
All right, Sheila. I hope you stay well. Julie.
You know, that was one of the other major findings of this survey is the number of people who are now in these high deductible plans. That's a particularly high deductible.
Whoa.
But there are now as many people in what are known as high deductible plans, and that's really defined now as over $1,000 deductible, not this kind of $5,000 deductible. But there are as many people now in high deductible plans with some sort of, usually there's some sort of savings account attached to them. Sometimes the employer makes a contribution to that savings account. Sometimes it's up to the individual to make the contribution to that savings account, and that's usually a tax-preferred savings account. There's many people in those high-deductible plans as there are in HMOs as of this year. So it's really, and in small businesses, it's more than half.
But
it is really becoming the norm for and a lot of these people are now what are really defined by statisticians as being underinsured, which means they're at risk of spending more than 10% of their income on health care out of pocket.
Clearly.
So they have insurance, but in some cases it's what kind of insurance do they have?
Well, but even beyond that, Sheila has said she's putting off going in for that second test. Now, could that turn into even more serious illness for which, as you pointed out, Ron, without her husband's company's insurance, who is going to pay for it? Joe?
Well, that's a really big question. And it's hard to know in her case, obviously. Will she be, uncompensated care, what we call uncompensated care. It's hard to know. One of the facts, though, that we know about healthcare, anybody who's ever looked at their explanation of benefits from their insurance company, is that the charge is very high. what the insurance company pays is much lower. What you end up paying is much lower than that. And so I'm a little surprised that she doesn't have insurance where they're negotiating rates.
Sheila, do you have that kind of insurance?
No, I get it on my own, privately.
Oh, I see.
So one of the things that Julie pointed out before, under the Affordable Care Act, people will be getting preventive care services, and they will not be charged for those preventive care services. So the kind of tests that Sheila will need, she will be able to receive them without having to go out of pocket for those costs. You know, for folks who are uninsured, who are priced out of the market, whether they're priced out of the market because they can't pay the premiums or the deductibles are so high that they don't feel they can pay those first dollars, you know, what do? Like Sheila, they defer care. And when they defer care, it means at the onset of a pain, at the onset of an illness, they delay getting care and the situation can get worse. And
Ron Pollack, he's Executive Director of Families USA. And we'll take a short break here. Sheila, I wish you well.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the Annie E. Casey Foundation, whose Kids Count report provides state-level data on the well-being of kids and families at aecf.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, providing resources to improve the quality of health care, online at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
Emmy and Tony Award winner John Lithgow on the drama in his life and how his father set him on the path to a career in acting. The Diane Rehm Show. Next hour. And we're back. Time to go back to the phones to Green Cove Springs, Florida. Good morning, Ernie.
How are you doing, Diane Rehm?
I'm fine, thank you, sir.
I've had 3 heart attacks since October of last year. Before that, I lost my insurance because of the economy failing completely along with my business. When I had my first heart attack, I was crying over my spreadsheets. Okay? Now, I'm only making $675 a month disability, which I had to fight tooth and nail 6 months for, okay? My bills, no matter how I look at it, are $1,000. I've already lost everything. I've lost house, everything. I've lost everything. I do have a car. However, I'm going to be, I mean, the insurance premiums I'm looking at are between $10,000 and $15,000 for my pre-existing conditions. If I make less,
limits.
Let me just go back to Ernie for a moment, because what he said was, why didn't you say that up front? It strikes me that the negative press about the Affordable Care Act has reached the public much more clearly than the positive elements. And Joe Antos, I would ask you why you think that is.
Well, I don't think that is true, actually.
You don't?
No. I think it's very hard to know what the public knows. The public doesn't know things that haven't happened, and none of this has happened. We can't expect the public to know what might happen in 2014. 2 years is a long time. 3 years is a long time. The other fact here is that we have to deal with. Ron's talking about great subsidies, and they sound wonderful, but either somebody's got to pay for it, or we've got to find some way to get the cost down. And in fact, if you go into any hospital in America, virtually any hospital in America, you're going into a palace. If you go into virtually any good hospital in any other part of the developed world, you'll be going to a place that has wards. We phased those out in the 50s. So we've got a lot of amenity value to our health care, in addition to real health care. And sorting that out is going to be very difficult in this country.
But I still want to understand why the negative parts of this program, some people feeling as though it is going to skyrocket costs, some people feeling, as Ernie did, that his wages, whatever his income is going to be garnished by the IRS. I mean, that's negative stuff, and the positive stuff you all talk about has not found its way into the public mind. Let's go back to the phones to Oklahoma City. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Diane. I want to thank you for convening this panel and taking the time to get to the bottom of a few things beyond the sound bites. I want to say that you've done a good job so far in pointing out the Kaiser numbers are absolutely not news, since we've had many, many years of double-digit increases. I just want to say that I really believe that the watchdogs are asleep. We have a lot of medical overuse, and the gentleman that called in with the heart attack problem, we should point out that he will be eligible for Medicare, disability medical, 24 months after he starts receiving that benefit, before he meets the poverty guideline and goes on Medicaid.
So that's a good point.
That's another benefit for him. But I think the way this Kaiser business was handled was just an anti-Obama gift to the right-wing radio hawkers. I think it was handled very poorly. The big problem is we now see the average family cost for insurance at $15,000 a year. That's well more than the average family taxes, and it's certainly more than many families pay for their rent or mortgage annually. And those of us lucky enough to have an employer-paid plan that's close to $15,000, that's money that will never be in my paycheck. We've talked about flat wages on some other programs, but we're way overusing medical care. The average person taking medicine under any kind of a plan is getting 4.5 prescriptions. This is just unheard of in the world. Nobody else does medical care this way.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling. Ron.
Well, Robert's got a very important point. We actually pay per procedure or per service as opposed to pay for good outcomes. And that's something that has to change. The Affordable Care Act moves us in that direction. The faster we move in that direction, the better off we will be. But, Diane, you raised the question, why is it that people like Ernie feel that the Affordable Care Act could potentially be a problem when he's going to benefit enormously from it? I mean, let's face it, this has been a real partisan political football. You know, I'm surprised so far that we haven't heard attacks that the Affordable Care Act actually caused Hurricane Irene, that it caused the earthquake in Virginia. Obamacare. I think one of the things that scares people who don't like the Affordable Care Act is that when we get to 2014 and it gets implemented, and people, as Joe said, you know, you have to see what actually how it impacts in your lives. Once that is implemented and people actually see the benefits of it, they receive the subsidies on premiums, they get help with respect to out-of-pocket costs, then I think we're going to see a very different situation that does leave the Affordable Care Act vulnerable between now and then. But I think we're going to see Obamacare being a badge of distinction for President Obama at some point.
All right, let's go now to Shane. He's in Austin, Texas. Good morning to you, Shane.
Oh, hello.
What's going on in the background?
Oh, that might be my motor. I'm actually, I pulled off the side of the road to talk
okay.
to you guys.
Go ahead.
I didn't get in an accident.
Okay.
I just wanted to kind of put something out there that I hear this discussion over and over again because it's, you know, it's big news and everything. But I don't have insurance.
How old are you, Shane?
I am 39 years old.
Okay.
And I don't feel like it's valuable to me. My children have Medicare because, you know, if there's an emergency that they have to go to the doctor, then they do. But we use preventative care. I mean, I've been going to a chiropractor since I was very young, and you know, I've been eating good, taking vitamins.
Good. I'm glad. Hey, Shane, tell me about your pardon me, your employment situation.
I'm a massage therapist. I help keep people nice and relaxed so
good.
That their stress levels don't rise. And stress is a major contributor to bad health.
Of course, and you make a decent income.
Actually, the highest I've ever made as a massage therapist is about $30,000 a year.
Okay, Julie, so what happens to Shane making $30,000 a year who has no health insurance? His children are covered under Medicaid.
Probably
is that
Medicaid, yeah.
Yeah.
He would probably, it depends where he lives, he would certainly be eligible. He might be one of those people who might be right on the edge of being either eligible for Medicaid himself or not required, not have enough income to be hit by the mandate, I would think.
But he's if he's not eligible for Medicaid,
yeah,
he'll be able to get individual coverage through these new marketplaces, and he is the perfect candidate for getting huge subsidies
yeah.
that will help pay for his premiums. And one of the key things is we've got to get people like Shane enrolled, and thankfully there's a big process, a new organization called Enroll America that's designed to make that happen.
All right, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, John.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm good, thanks, sir.
I just want, you know, I'm not really going to complain too much because a lot of people have more problems than me, but I'm a self-employed person, sole proprietor, and my premiums have gone up basically around 500% over the course of the past 9-10 years. And I think that, you know, solely insured small pool people pay a large proportion of premiums vis-a-vis large pool institutions. I understand the numbers behind that, but also on the negotiated prices. I had a back surgery a few years ago. It cost $17,000 if I was uninsured. It cost me $5,000 with insurance. So why can't the layperson have the same power of negotiation, the uninsured person have the same power of negotiation as an insured person with a company who pays high premiums?
Julie.
That's exactly what the new exchanges under the Affordable Care Act are supposed to do. That's what these exchanges are for. They're for the small business person, for the sole proprietor.
Would he be affected?
He will be able to go into these exchanges and get small businesses are already eligible for tax credits. If he employ, I'm sorry, didn't catch whether
he was self-employed.
Self-employed. Okay, uh-huh. So he'll be able to go into the exchange as a self-employed self-employed will be able to pool with other self-employed people to get this much to basically have the power of group purchasing and probably be eligible for subsidies as well.
Last quick question from Sarevsko, Michigan. Good morning, Leroy. Please, quick question.
Good morning. I just had a notice that I'm retired, and it's $96.40 a month for our Medicare, and I read that it's going to go up to $247 in 2014.
Where did you read that?
Well, I got it off the internet now, whether it's true or not. The internet
okay.
Stuff is.
Okay, Julie.
I think you're just talking about his Part B premium. There may be
yes.
You may be talking about an income-related Part B premium, and that may be a proposal.
Joseph.
No, I've heard this before. It's for the average person who's paying the standard premium, by 2014, it may rise to $140.
So that's what I'm talking about. I think there is a lot of bad information out there. A lot of myths. Leroy has just brought up one. Where they're coming from, I do not know, but we have to do a better job of getting the right information out there. You all have done a great job this morning. Thank you, Ron Pollack, Julie Robner, Joseph Pantos. I'm going to be on vacation for the next 2 weeks. Yay! I'll be back with you on October the 17th. I look forward to being with you then. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.